right here on PRN. Everyone, I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, the irony of a national holiday for a man, Martin Luther King Jr., that the government assassinated. Who says? William Pepper says. Who is William Pepper? He's an international civil and human rights attorney based in New York, best known for representing Martin Luther King's accused assassin, James Earl Ray. In 1967, Dr. King had reached out to Dr. Pepper regarding an essay he had written for Ramparts magazine concerning Vietnamese victims of American napalm missions. He was present at Dr. King's famous Riverside Church speech. Bill was the citizens' chairman for Robert Kennedy's run for the Senate in Westchester County and also a counsel for Robert Kennedy's assassin, Syrian, arguing there was a second shooter. William received undergraduate and graduate degrees from Columbia University, a doctorate in education, the University of Massachusetts, a Juris Doctoral degree from Boston College, and also studied at the London School of Economics and Political Science. His book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., was the result of 39 years of impeccable research and scholarship, and the gathering of documentation and sworn testimonies on new confirmed information that will revise the history behind the assassination of Dr. King. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. It's good to be with you again.
We're going to get to several different issues today, but more specifically, I want to begin by a quote from your book. Quote, "To understand his death, it is essential to realize that although he is popularly depicted and perceived as a civil rights leader, he was much more than that. A nonviolent revolutionary, he personified the most powerful force for the long overdue social, political, and economic reconstruction of the nation." End quote. Today, there is complete distrust of our government in Washington, D.C., in state capitals, in both sides of the conservative-liberal divide. Yet there is the irony that our government honors Martin Luther King Day. Revolutionaries are always a threat to the power elite. All those things he stood for, anti-war, anti-nuclear, rights of immigrants, inequality, etc. And if he were alive today, I'm sure climate justice and other activities that have been repressed by our government would be at the forefront of his agenda. Yet our government, which assassinated him, honors King with a holiday. What is the irony behind this, and how has King been hijacked and used as a meaningless symbol for our politicians on both sides of the aisle? The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, I think your analysis is correct, and it's not only ironical, it's devastatingly tragic, and it's reflective of the failure of public education in America and the ability to take American public school students from the earliest ages and to teach them to think critically, not only about their daily lives and how they live them and decisions they make, but more broadly about their government and what the government tells them every day. And the government continues to tell them. And the present administration, of course, in America is the extreme, in my view, in that respect. A man who has told nearly 16,000 lies in public and who has betrayed every aspect of a Democratic president and the responsibilities of a of such a an office holder under the Constitution of this republic. So it's a very, what you're pointing out, Gary, is a very broad national and cultural problem that has afflicted America and is going to be very difficult to overcome as the impeachment proceedings are demonstrating before our very eyes and ears. Yes, so they are capable of taking a figure like Martin King and twisting and distorting his real value, his real worth, and what he truly believed in. And not only Martin King, of course, but they will do this with every other dissenting figure, individual, who gets in the way. Assassination, as we have learned, is the last resort. If they can demolish the reputation, make a person unemployable, impoverish them in one way or another, keep them out of the public eye, as they've done with performers over the decades, like Pete Seeger, if they can get away with handling dissent that way, they do it. But ultimately, if they can't, and if the individual's commitment is too strong and conscience compels action, not just thoughts, not just speeches, but actual action, then assassination is the tactic that is used. Indeed, it's been used throughout history, but it's particularly devastating to us as we see the descent of an American Democratic Republic slowly but unmistakably into fascism.
Thank you for that overview. I would like to share with you my own personal perspective, and then I would like for you to offer your own challenges to it and certainly broaden it out to your perspective, since you knew King, I did not. Based upon his beliefs, and he was a Republican, he was on the progressive conservative side. And yes, there is a progressive conservative political movement in this country. It receives no attention, but it's there. And he was attacked repeatedly by the liberal community. Not everyone, but certainly the corporatists were after him in a major way, and the Southern Democrats in particular. It is my belief that if King were alive today, he would be booed off college campuses. He would be the target of mockery and disdain. He would have a hate page on Wikipedia, the establishment's go-to place to destroy people's reputations without due course or due process. He would not be accepted by any of the so-called liberal media, MSNBC and CNN, etc., because his ideas were not compromisable. And everything today is some homogenized, blenderized, standardized pattern of accepting the status quo. And in that context, you were with him when he was at the Riverside Church and gave his famous speech. One of the key observations you and other King historians have noted was that Dr. King's own thoughts were evolving and expanding. And this was in line with the increase in his sphere of influence. It wasn't simply civil rights for African Americans, but more about civil rights for all and the need for a dramatic systemic change in the U.S. government and Washington policies and the corporations that were supported by them, and that included the media. So if there was any chance of preserving American democracy, he was for it, and that was one of the reasons I believe that he represented a threat. So please share with us your own personal experiences and meetings with Dr. King, and then speak, if you will, on whether or not my own suppositions about where he would fit today. he would be similar to Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey and Bruce Dixon and the Black Agenda Report people, people who are very progressive but completely rejected by the liberal community. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think you've touched on some very significant, broad overview issues. When I met him for the first time, he had delivered a sermon at Brown University and had asked me to ride with him up to Harvard, where we opened Vietnam Summer. That was in 1967. Some 7-8 months after the Ramparts piece came out. I brought along materials that had not appeared in the piece, mainly photographic materials, and showed them to him because he had asked me if I had other documents that I would want him to see. And when he looked at those photographs, he literally wept. There was something that touched him to such an extent that it brought out the truth of his soul with respect to this kind of devastation that was being visited upon these ancient people. I remember that. He came back. He had come back to me in March of 67, asked me if I would consent to nominate him and Dr. Benjamin Spock as a third-party ticket against Lyndon Johnson. He had come to the conclusion that only by formally entering political life could he organize and rally people around the cause of the end of the war. And I did that before a rather large crowd of people in front of the United Nations. But he wanted me also to make it clear that he was not the slightest bit interested in money or power that office would bring him, but it was only to cause the American people to focus on the evil and the injustice and the war criminality that their government was waging with their money. Now, your analysis of how he would be received today, I think, is basically correct. I think he would be regarded as uncompromisable, which is a good word to use with respect to him. And I thank you for that. And he would show an inflexibility in terms of the values that he held dear. And he regarded Gandhian nonviolence as the way to go, but he was very much a revolutionary. He had come all the way from being a civil rights leader to a human rights advocate. And he would not compromise with respect to that commitment and the values that led to it. It is very interesting that he was empowered, in my view, and deeply empowered by love. He never in my presence said anything negative, any insulting or critically negative about any of his enemies. He tried very much to understand even the most hateful among them, and he tried to overcome through his entire life hatred, which he would show even to the people who were determined to kill him. And he knew he would be killed. He said that in his last speech, where he indicated that he might not reach the promised land with his followers. He was betrayed within his own organization continually.
Who betrayed him? Excuse me.
yes.
Who betrayed him? Was he aware that he was being betrayed? And what happened to those individuals who did the betraying? What do we know that can be proven, not hearsay, about the people who betrayed him?
Well, the main betrayer, in my view, was the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And I came to learn a lot about Jackson early on in my work, which, as you said, has gone on for nearly 40 years. It was Jackson who arranged the change of his room from 202 on the ground floor, which was secure and protected, to the second floor balcony room, where he was wide open and heavily exposed. It was Jackson who did that, and I know how he did it because I deposed a man who, as a teenage boy, was present when his mother, who was in the Dixie Mafia family that J. Edgar Hoover used to carry out work on the ground for the assassination, when she called and gave the instructions that Jesse had to change the room, that only Jesse would be able to do that. So that was one instance. The second instance was that it was Jackson who moved the invaders, the Black Panther group who were there to work with Martin King in the final stages of a march they were planning. Jackson had them thrown out of the hotel about a half hour before the assassination. They had two rooms there. They had committed to work for a peaceful march with Martin. They were armed, and they were uncontrollable in terms of the assassination forces. So he moved them out of the room. The next morning, though Memphis was in a lockdown position, it was somehow possible for Jesse Jackson to get out, to be flown out the night before, and to appear on the Today Show out of Chicago. And one of the invaders, whom I interviewed all of them individually, one of them told me that they knew well that Jackson, who came out of South Carolina, was given a letter of introduction to Strom Thurmond to Richard Daley. And in that letter it said, please take care of this young man. He's one of our own. So with all of that information, I have little sympathy or credibility in my mind for the independence of Jesse Jackson. Now he did not know this. He would oppose things that Jackson wanted to do, but he did it on a policy, on a humanitarian basis. He didn't try to evict him from the organization. Although he lost his temper with him upon occasion, he thought it was that Jesse's foibles, if you will, were just a natural bent of his personality and his desire to assert himself. But he was clearly on the other side, and clearly led to the death of King. Reverend Samuel Billy Kyles is another local minister very close to Jackson, whose job it was to get King out of the room at about 6 o'clock on the day of the assassination. He knocked on the door. He lied that he went into the room and spent some time. He knocked on the door. It opened and was shut fairly quickly. Then he walked out the balcony and remained about 60 to 75 feet on the other end of the balcony. When Martin came out, he didn't approach him because he knew what was going to happen. So Kyles, in my view, he was a paid police informant. So, I mean, those are two examples of individuals. There were others, but I don't need to go into details.
No. Bill, what I would like to do is, if you would please, for the uninitiated in this audience, would you take the time to lay out the proof, not supposition, not hearsay, not speculation, but the absolute proof that you have that the United States government, who in the government, from the highest down to the shooter, were responsible for King's death, and what the news media has never reported on, but you have absolute proof of?
Yes. Well, very, very sad piece of news that I was able to locate the son of the head of the Dixie Mafia group, who was very close to working with Hoover on any number of other local projects. But with Carlos Marcello out of New Orleans, this was an intermediary group that was racist and was determined to be available to make money, but also arrange for the assassination of Martin King. And I was able to get the son of that Adkins family, Russell Adkins was the man's name, who died, and deposed him over a period of 2 days and grilled him just as ferociously as I could. And it became clear to me, and it was a surprise to me, that into Memphis on a regular basis, bringing money and written instructions from Edgar Hoover, was Tolson, his number two. Clyde Tolson, who was the number two of the FBI, Hoover's confidant, lover, and total trusted person, was the go-between. He was not known that much, but so he could be the front for Hoover. And indeed he was. He would come in and out. And I have photographs of Tolson with the Adkins family throughout. He was very instrumental in carrying out Hoover's orders. And this young man, who I was able to depose, was in his presence many times, was able to sit in on the donuts and coffee meetings that planned the assassination and that worked on them. So that's direct evidence. It's not in any way really hearsay. This is a participant. This young man was a participant in these meetings. He was present. He saw everything that was going on. On two occasions, Tolson and his father went out of the country on a transatlantic cruise. He gave me a copy of the ticket that his father had. So they worked very closely together, and I have no doubt he had no reason to lie. And he identified who the shooter was. He identified who the spotter was. The shooter was the best shot in the Memphis police force, an officer called Frank Strouser, who still is around today. Earl Clark was another collaborator, very good shot as well, but he was the spotter. And they went into the bushes behind Jim's Grill, which was a cafe owned by Lloyd Jowers, who owed a substantial amount of money to Frank Liberto, a mob guy for gambling debts. And it was Jowers who brought the rifle after the shooting into the back of his kitchen and in front of his black lover, who happened incidentally to come looking for him, thinking he might be out in the bushes fooling around with some other women. She was right there as he ran by her, broke the gun down, and said to her, "You wouldn't ever do anything to hurt me, Betty, would you?" And she said, no, Lloyd, of course I wouldn't. That was in 68, of course, and it took me until 1992, 93, to get Betty to tell the real story. So that is I think a lot of that is evidence. The thing that is not known, and it will not be known unless people really read the detail in the book that you mentioned, The Plot to Kill King. In that book, the truth about how Martin King died is set out. Martin King did not die from the gunshot, from the bullet, which entered just above his jawbone and went down and nicked his spine. It might well have killed him, and he might well have died, ultimately, from that experience. But he didn't. He was alive when he was taken to the hospital, and they were working on him in the hospital when the chief of neurosurgery came in with two men in suits and emptied the room, told them to stop working on that, and let him die, and anyway, you're not needed here. Go on out. So...
Hold on one second. I just want to apologize to our audience for the word that you used. It's inappropriate. I understand the context. You're quoting him verbatim, but we have to be sensitive with these issues.
Yes, I'm quoting directly the word that is the inappropriate word, but I was quoting it directly just to be accurate. As she was leaving the room, a surgical nurse heard the three men gather up spit in their mouths. That caught her attention. She was at the door about the last one out, and she turned around and she saw them spit on the body of Dr. King. And then she saw the chief of neurosurgery pick up the pillow from under his head and put it over his face and suffocate him to death. He was still breathing at the time. Now, as I said, he might well have died anyway from the bullet wound, but that is clearly what happened to him and how he died. This information, Gary, is on these people, the son of the Dixie Mafia group and the surgical nurse. These are people who did not want publicity. There's nothing in it for them. Even Jower's lover, nothing. She held back for so long, actually believing it was Jowers who fired the fatal shot. But they have no reason to lie. They have no reason to lie. And in my view, the circumstances render their statements under oath, always under oath, and on film, render their statements truthful. So that's the position I've taken. I've interviewed, deposed scores of witnesses and just put a number on the sidelines as of questionable credibility. But these critical people are brave, they're courageous, and their word is something that I treasure, as I do their courage.
Clearly, the media participated, certain members of the media participated, because they accepted without challenge or independent investigation that James Earl Ray was a racist, an expert marksman, and had a motive to kill King. Deconstruct the myth that the American media and the federal government, especially the FBI under Hoover, totally corrupt organization, had to say about James Earl Ray, and your own evolution of going from believing he was the killer to where you would later defend him.
Yes, yes. Yes, that was an evolutionary process. You're quite right, Gary. From 1968 onward, I believed that James was... All the media coverage took the position that he was guilty, that he was a lone racist. Well, that was 1968. In 1977, Ralph Abernathy came to me, Martin's friend, and asked me if I would go to the prison and depose James, or if not depose him, at least interview him for a period of time. And I was shocked. I couldn't believe that Ralph wanted that done. And I think he wanted it done for reasons other than I realized at the time, frankly. But anyway, it took several months to prepare, and in August of 78, I guess it was, in August of 78, imagine that, over 10 years later, I went up to the prison and deposed James Earl Ray for 5 hours and put him through a rather grueling interview. Present also, of course, was Abernathy and the Reverend James Lawson, who was a dear, dear friend of Martin's. So at the end of that five-hour kind of torrential inquiry, everyone in that room believed that this man was not the shooter. He might have been involved, but he wasn't the shooter. And it took me from 1978 to 1988 to finally convince myself that he was an unknowing patsy. And what happened there was he had been profiled by Hoover's request of the Commissioner of Corrections in the state of Missouri, and they chose Ray as someone whom they could use. And James didn't know it, of course, at the time, but his escape was facilitated, and then he was handled. He was managed, his movements were pretty much taken care of. He was paid, and he linked up with a fellow called Raoul, whom the government and the House Select Committee on Assassinations tried desperately to prove didn't exist. But Raoul gave James the money that he needed to buy out the white Mustang, and moved him around. James took all of his instructions, and we never knew that James was even when I became convinced he was an unknowing patsy. We didn't know that they had helped his escape. And the way I found that out was Hoover sent $25,000 in by Tolson that was given to Russell Adkins. And my witness, his son, all those years later, described riding to the prison with the money in a bag that they turned over to the warden. And the warden's job was to facilitate the ultimate escape of James, which was done in 1965. He was allowed to escape, and he was kept on the string until they had the opportunity to carry out the plot. Now, what happened was, this is interesting, Gary. What happened was, Martin King was to have been killed in Los Angeles. He was to have been assassinated in Los Angeles. Now, I know that because James was kept in Los Angeles in his movements. He was held there for quite a period of time, as were the sniper unit, the eight-man sniper unit that was the backup unit. If a civilian couldn't get him, they were never going to let him leave the city. So they were all kept under ropes in Los Angeles, and that was the place that they were going to kill Martin. And then I kicked myself because for a number of years I didn't put two and two together and understand why they all of a sudden moved them from Los Angeles into the South, and Memphis had taken on and become the meaningful place for the assassination. The reason that was done because they had decided, the ruling forces, we're talking now, about their agents and government had decided to take Bob Kennedy out in Los Angeles if he won the Democratic nomination and for president. They couldn't have two assassinations in the same city of that sort. So they had to have a second place, and Memphis became the second site. And so they moved the team out of there and set them up in Memphis and organized everything to take place in Memphis.
If you've just joined us, this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. My guest is William Pepper. He has spent more time researching Martin Luther King's background and the events around his death than any other person I'm aware of. He has multiple graduate degrees. He is an author of the book, The Plot to Kill King. He spent 39 years researching and engaging in scholarship, has done hundreds of sworn depositions and testimony that has been filmed, and yet the American media has not touched any of this. And William, you were invited by the King family to represent it in a civil suit. Tell us about that suit and what was revealed during that trial.
Yes, I was well into my work when I received a phone call from Martin's nephew, Isaac Farris, who asked me if I would... this was after the first book. I've written three books on the case, Orders to Kill, An Act of State, and the last one, which is the final book, Plot to Kill King. But after Orders to Kill was done in 1995, Isaac called and asked me if I... He read it and was sufficiently moved. So he asked me if I would meet with the family and discuss the case and what I had found out. I agreed to do that, and I met with them. And they, in turn, through Dexter King, Martin's son, went to the prison and actually met with James. And the family reviewed all the evidence and became convinced that James was a patsy. And James died in 1998. And I finally had agreed to represent him completely in 1988. Remember, Abernathy and I spoke in 77, 78. I interviewed James in August of 78, and then it took me 10 years of going back and forth to the prison, questioning him, talking to him, and him asking me to represent him, where I finally did. And he died in prison. I failed. I couldn't get an evidentiary hearing for him. So I failed. We had done a television trial that was a very powerful rendition of the facts that we knew, but that was back in 93. And by 99, we knew a lot more. And so the family then agreed that I would represent them, and they would sue Lloyd Jowers, who was a member of the owner of Jim's Grill, and we had a lot of evidence about him. So we sued him, and we tried the case for 30 days. We had 70 witnesses, and it took the jury, a local jury in Memphis. It was a civil action. It took the jury 59 minutes to acquit, to find James as being innocent, and to nail agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, city of Memphis, as being responsible for the assassination of Martin King. And you're quite right. This has never been covered. This has never been covered. It's vast majority of Americans don't even know such a trial took place. And your analysis of the media is spot on. If it weren't for people like you doing what you do, Americans would never get a glimpse of the truth of some of these more politically justifiably politically cases that are buried. They simply wouldn't. You remember Bernstein told us back in Watergate days that he had learned that the CIA had become amongst the largest publishers in the world, and that Sulzberger gave Alan Dulles, the CIA, 12 slots on the Times, and those 12 slots would continue to be continued to be rotated. And that was evident to me in this case, because articles would appear without any substance whatsoever. Column one, front page of the New York Times, with an article by a journalist named Waldron, who said that that there was no Raoul. Ray got his money from robbing a bank with his brothers in Alton, Illinois. Now, I called the chief of police at Alton and the president of the bank, and they both said they never thought of such a thing. They knew who robbed the bank. They just didn't have enough evidence to prove of it. It certainly wasn't the Ray brothers or James Earl Ray. They would never even consider it in consideration. They further said that no one from the New York Times, would you believe, had ever even asked their opinions. Both chief of police and president of the bank had never been inquired. And yet here comes this article that, once again, this was during the time of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. I was asked to represent Jerry Ray at that time, and I did. And when they raised this in the House Select Committee hearings, I, on a point of order, I gave this whole story to the committee counsel and told them exactly this, what I've just told you. And they immediately went silent, and they went on to the next topic. But if you read the report of the committee this day, you will find that they still say James was funded by monies from the Alton, Illinois bank robbery. So the Times has collaborated with this over the years, and I've been told that I personally am blacklisted by the Times. After the 99 trial, my name appeared one time because one of the witnesses referred to me as having presented certain evidence, but my name has never appeared in the Times since then. And I'm told that it's because of the kind of blacklist that they do. Now, that's a frightful thing to say to one of America's most liberal newspapers, whose subscription I, of course, I canceled, and I now am a subscriber to the Washington Post, which I find to be far more untouched by its ownership and the intelligence community who acts on behalf of the ruling forces. So we need people like you, Gary, and your colleagues who are not afraid to tell the truth, to get it out there in the open. I just wish you well. I hope you continue with the work that you're doing and have done all these years.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I do not consider the New York Times a liberal publication. I consider it the publication of mendacity and mediocrity and oligarchy. Because look at who they defend, look at who they promote, look at who they have a virtually unabridged loyalty to. Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, the people around Obama and Clinton, the Washington Consensus. You don't see them ever challenging any of the things that we now know are completely false. They have not once led on any major issue. It's the public that is led, individual investigative journalists, including at one time their own reporter, Chris Hedges, who won a Pulitzer. Now, if you're asking, do they get the ball scores right? Yeah, they do. And the obituaries, more often than not. But would I trust anything that they say on in their editorials? Not at all.
Well, they haven't reviewed any of my books.
That shouldn't surprise any progressive.
No.
Now let's only have 10 minutes left, and what I would like to do is I would like to go back to your confrontations with the shooter, who's still alive, and how you got some of these people to actually tell the truth, because normally when you're dealing with organized crime figures, they have a very strict code that if you talk, you die. So you got a lot of these people to talk. Tell us about that side of the story.
Well, it is interesting, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that time lapses and people's getting closer to their ultimate demise often has an impact on their conscience when they want to speak up and share things that they know before they pass away. As for the shooter, it was really not very eventful. I invited him to lunch. He knew who I was. I invited him to lunch. I offered him $500 to come sit down, have lunch with me, and have a conversation. He was, maybe, probably still is, driving a taxi cab in Memphis for a living, and so he needs money. So he came along, and he wouldn't eat at all, being very scrupulous about that, but he was willing to talk. It was pretty clear to me that there was very strong elements of racism that persisted in his personality. His brother had been killed in Vietnam. He was, in many ways, he feared to be a bitter man. I understand after the shooting, after the assassination, he pretty much became persona non grata with the police department because he felt he had too much on them, and particularly on Frank Holloman, who was the chief of police and fire, and who was formerly at Hoover's office for 8 years in Washington, and in overall supervision of the operation in Memphis. But this guy would run prostitutes out of a squad car. I had really spoke with someone who rode with him, and there was a purse snatching once, and he refused to chase the guy, just pulled out his gun and shot him dead. He was calling attention to himself in a negative way and wanted to make it clear that he could do what he wanted to do. And eventually they got rid of him, got him off the police force, that is. But it wasn't that easy. He was identified to me by the janitor of the police firing range, who used to watch him and hear him and listen to him, and the day of the shooting saw him practicing all day up until he left at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, all day with a special rifle that had been brought in for the purpose. And so we talked in a more or less non-revealing way. At one point, one of the most interesting points of the conversation was I pointed to his shoes, and I said, you wear very large shoes, don't you? And he said, yep, and he had a grin on his face. And he said, 13, size 13, he said. Well, he knew that I knew that a plaster of Paris cast had been made of the shoes of the shooter or someone who was with the shooter in the bushes after when the police arrived, and the size of that the plaster of Paris shoe was 13. So he knew about that. I was on to Frank Liberto, who was a local mafia lieutenant who had very good relationship with the police department, and he used to work with them on all kinds of cases having to do with drugs and prostitution, and he was one of Marcello's guys in Memphis, and very, very available. But it got to be difficult for him to do anything to harm me, because I did not discuss publicly or in any way what I was coming up with, and I kept most of my work very quiet in those days, and was not taken seriously, as I didn't publish anything, and I just worked. Memphis is a mob town, with no question about that. So one had to be very, very careful, and I tried to I tried to stay alive. I had three children and a family, and I had to move my my family out of the States. Though you're right about that, I moved them when one day my 4-year-old son got a picked up the phone by mistake and got hurt a threat on his father's life. And I said, well, we can't do this. I can't raise
Bill,
these kids this way.
Bill, we only have 4 minutes left. You had accused Jesse Jackson as being a part of the conspiracy. Have you ever confronted Jackson to get his side of the story, to allow him a chance to defend himself?
No, it's interesting. I haven't, but others have. The reason I have it is because I understand that he's suffering from a form of dementia now, and has been for quite some time, and it's getting worse. And people who had offered to do that, and I had encouraged them to do it, and he's very much aware of what I've written, what I've said, indicated that he appears to be really running out of any recollection, or at least that's what it appears to be. And I have seen him in public at various films, the things that there's clearly something wrong there. So I have not done that. That may be an omission, but others I know have, and are still trying to get him to comment, but they've not been successful. He just doesn't remember things that went on in that period of.
In an earlier discussion, you said that you also had evidence that he was an FBI informant.
Yes, I believe that he was, when he left South Carolina and he went up to Chicago, I believe that he was paid by the FBI and was a dual handler, both local police, where he's useful, and the Bureau. And I know when Tolson brought money in, according to Young Adkins, when Tolson brought money in, there was a name always on each of the bags he had, and Jackson's name was, which held the money, and Jackson's name was on one of those bags.
Do you have that information under oath, filmed?
Okay, what I did was I deposed Russell Adkins. And it was 2 days. I think the total time I have been close to 9, 10, 11 hours. So I imagine that, I'm quite sure that's that would have been covered by one of the depositions. It's a very extensive deposition that I did when this fellow finally agreed to talk.
Final quick answer on this. Did you ever interview the head of the Memphis Mafia?
Well, that's interesting. The answer to your question is no. He was a very laid-back guy who seemed to be involved only on certain aspects of Marcello's work there. And most of his work was done by his hands-on work was done by a fellow called Frank Liberto, who died in the late 70s, I believe. But it was Liberto who was a key guy in terms of organizing and indeed admitting before a witness that he was responsible for organizing the killing of Martin King. And I did not ever interview Liberto. One of the reasons I was reluctant to go to these people was, frankly, it would have blown my cover in terms of what I was looking at and the degree of information that I had.
It also could have probably caused you to be killed. You don't go up to an organized crime head and ask them were they complicit.
Sure. When I moved the family to Cambridge, my first family, was raised in Cambridge, England. I ended up commuting back and forth to the States and in particular to Memphis. And that was a heavy price to pay, frankly. I missed a lot of significant times with young children growing up when I had to follow through on this case.
William Pepper, thank you for 39 years' worth of work bringing us the truth, something the mainstream media is incapable of. The government was complicit and therefore not going to acknowledge their own complicity. But at least we who want to know the truth now have it. We appreciate it. The book is The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and the author is William Pepper. Thanks a lot.
Gary, thank you for all you do.
I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.
Hey, man.